Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
MSW Media.
I'm Greg Oliar. 4 years ago, I stopped writing novels to report on the crimes of Donald Trump and his associates. In 2018, I wrote a best-selling book about it, Dirty Rubles. In 2019, I launched Prevail, a biweekly column about Trump and Putin, spies and mobsters, and so many traitors! Trump may be gone, but the damage he wrought will take years to fully understand. Join me and a revolving crew of contributors and guests as we try to make sense of it all. This is Prevail.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 44 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. It is Wednesday, November 17th. I am your co-host, Andrew Torres, and filling in for Allison Gill is special guest host Eli Bosnick. Eli, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. And I think I speak for your audience when I say, thank God I am not your co-host now and forever, Andrew Torres.
Oh, Eli, I'm seriously thrilled that we could find a time to record together. Like, I love talking politics with you. We had a mutual cry and talked each other down after the 2016 elections. I think you are one of the smartest, funny voices in podcasting, as well as the funniest smart voice in podcasting. So what's your thought of our overall mission here at Cleanup, right? Like, look, obviously, a couple of weeks ago, the Democrats got destroyed in the off-year election. Supply chain disruptions are making it impossible to, you know, order anything. Gasoline is $80 a gallon. There's talk of inflation, which I always thought was something that was made up in the Reagan administration to, like, you know, scare economist kids or whatever. And Biden's approval ratings are in the low 40s. So we're looking at a red wave in 2022 and Trump pulling a Grover Cleveland after that. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I think the midterms are going to be rough. I mean, you got to remember, Trump was a villain who played out on the international stage, and damn near half the country still voted for four more years of Baron Harkonnen. I would love to be proven wrong about that, but I don't think I am. But the good news is, I think the 2024 primary is going to be a shit show of all shit shows that Trump comes out on top of, and the country will show up to stop him. So I will take 2 years of frustration and stalemate over four more years of horror any day.
Do you see that? Because everybody who is a prominent voice in the Republican Party, who's going to challenge Trump from the perspective of maybe we should be less crazy? Like, you know, Larry Hogan? I mean, I don't know. Like, the folks showing up in the polls are, you know, DeSantis, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz. Like, I don't know, man.
I mean, the good news is the only thing you can count on Republicans to be is power hungry. So at the slightest chance they might get to be president, absolutely every nutbag from the right is going to show up and put their dick on the podium for Trump to smash with his hardcore supporters of that low 20%.
Well, all right. I guess I'm looking forward to that.
Hey, it's... Can I just say, for my shows, great content. The primaries are primo comedy material. It's the general election that gets depressing. So before we do anything else, it's time to shout out your amazing patrons who help make this show possible by going to patreon.com/aisle45pod and signing up for as little as $1 an episode. You get a shout out on the show and you get an ad free feed, and patrons get a special pipeline to AG and Andrew where they read and respond to your messages.
Well, maybe not your messages, Eli.
I mean, look, if you guys didn't want to play Fuck, Marry, Kill with the Golden Girls, you shouldn't have accepted my dollar, Andrew. That's on you. That is on you.
That is true. And other dollars I have accepted this week include from Claire Ken, Robert Dillon, David Liedl, Ruth Ann Schallert-Weigel, Lisa McLean, Andrew Lake, and I became a Patreon to hear Andrew say, I'm a stinky old butt face.
That's right. $1 and my lawyer will say butt face on the air.
Yep, that is true. So with that out of the way, on to the A block. So, Eli, I'm so glad you're here to celebrate the newest holiday with me, Indictment Day.
Oh, and me without my Hanukkah candles.
That's right. Well, Friday at about 5 p.m., we learned that Merrick Garland's Department of Justice, the one that many, including you and I, have criticized for being too slow to indict Trump on federal charges that he didn't pardon himself for, where the statute of limitations is ticking, that DOJ handed down an indictment of former White House advisor Steve Bannon.
That's right. No word yet on whether they were aiming for Trump and just hit another sandworm by accident, though.
that is two Dune references in the first 6 minutes of the show.
Yeah, I watched it last night.
Oh, well, please accept my thanks for not watching Boogie Nights.
You are welcome, Andrew, because that is also on HBO Max. It was a tough chance. So Bannon was charged Friday with two counts of contempt of Congress after refusing to comply with a subpoena from the House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. He was indicted by a grand jury in Washington, which I understand is something the DOJ almost never does with respect to a dispute involving Congress. Okay, I'm not going to lie. I actually don't understand that, but that sentence sets you up to explain it. So, Andrew, what's the deal with that? What does that mean?
Yeah, these kind of indictments are incredibly rare. They have only happened three times in the past 30 years. But then again, past officials of both parties haven't taken the position of, hey, I used to work for Trump, so I can tell Congress to go fuck itself when it issues me a subpoena, right? Like, there were legitimate disputes in the past rather than sort of blanket nonsense, right? So the two counts that you mentioned, and we'll link to the indictment and to Attorney General Garland's press release in the show notes, they are for refusal to show up and provide testimony in connection with the September 23rd subpoena and the refusal to produce the documents that were also requested by that same subpoena.
All right. So, Andrew, are these serious charges? Is Bannon going to go to jail, he said, with his fingers crossed?
No. Okay. These are misdemeanor charges. They're both counts under 2 USC 192. But look, this is the only law that applies here, right? It says every person who, having been summoned as a witness by Congress to give testimony or produce papers upon any matter under inquiry, who having appeared refuses to answer any question pertinent to the question under inquiry shall be deemed guilty of a misdemeanor punishable by a fine of not more than $1,000, not less than $100, and imprisonment in a common jail for not less than 1 month or not more than 12 months. So, you know, you could get some jail time out of it, but I don't want to overstate kind of the way the system is supposed to work, which is it is supposed to deter you because the founding fathers that naively assumed that people in civil service would not want a criminal record.
Didn't see Bannon coming. But so he could do some jail time, some common jail time, whatever that means.
that common jail language lets you know that this is a semi-old-timey law. This is a law from 1938, which is when Congress stopped enforcing subpoenas on its own by sending out the House Marshal.
Not exactly the justice I was hoping for, Andrew.
Yeah. To be fair, you wrote in our notes, I was hoping RoboCop would shoot him in the penis.
Don't tell me not to dream. Do not tell me not to dream. So am I wrong to be pessimistic about this? Why wouldn't Bannon continue to just defy subpoenas if this is the punishment? I mean, I'm pretty sure he can afford the $2,000.
Yeah, look, I think there are a couple things to think about here, right? First,
what if RoboCop did shoot him in the penis?
All right. Then second.
Second.
Remember that this indictment is significant deterrence. You know, it might not be significant deterrence to Bannon, you know, but it is a deterrent to people who do still care about not having a criminal record. And I think that's people like, you know, former member of Congress Mark Meadows or Bill Stepien, right? Like, they are surely pondering right now, do they comply with the subpoenas that the 1-6 committee has sent to them? And knowing that, you know, there is a potential criminal charge coming if they get referred out to the DOJ, that I have some optimism with respect to that. And then and third, you know, we're dismissing Steve Bannon is not Roger Stone, right? Like, he's not looking to do a dime as a as a badge of honor so that he can get another Nixon tattoo, right? Like,
yeah.
Bannon complied with the Mueller investigation back in 2017. Like, I'm sure, you know, not fully and forthrightly and completely honestly, but like, he testified against Roger Stone, right?
So, okay. Yeah. So when you say that, okay, so when Merrick Garland's press release says that, quote, these charges reflect the Justice Department's commitment to show the American people by word and deed that the Justice Department adheres to the rule of law, follows the facts and the law, and pursues equal justice under the law, end quote, that there's some reason to think that might actually happen?
Well, I mean, that sort of sounds like the Superman narrator from the 1970s.
Sure does.
So let's not get too crazy, right? This is the bare minimum, and I'm glad to see that it happened, right? Like, there were folks who didn't think Bannon would get indicted at all. There are Republicans howling right now that, you know, prior Republican referrals to Democratic DOJs have not resulted in criminal referrals under this statute. Okay. Mm. It also means, I think AG won the bet we made last week. I gotta sort that out.
Anyway,
but I will tell you, after this, right, the indictment came down on Friday, and later that evening, co-chairs of the 1-6 Commission, Benny Thompson and, God help me, Liz Cheney, right? They sent a message to their former colleague, Mark Meadows. They said, your actions, quote, defy the law and will force the committee to consider contempt or other proceedings to enforce the subpoena.
All right. Let's hope they do. Now, you mentioned that there were three times the courts have ruled in these sort of cases in the past. What happened in those cases?
Yeah, so all three resulted in guilty pleas, but there's kind of a little asterisk, right? So two were for Iran-Contra flunkies, if you remember reading about that in school. One was Elliot Abrams, where still a fun fact today, if you Google his name, you will find that the first result is Elliot Abrams lies to Congress.
As it should be.
The other was a guy, even I had to look up, named Alan Fiers, right? A really sort of minor player. They served less than a year of probation and community service before being pardoned by George H.W. Bush in 1992. And third is a former George W. Bush head of the Office of Special Counsel. That's Scott Block.
Wait. Scott Block, that's the guy who destroyed emails and other documents from whistleblowers relating to pervasive discrimination against gays and lesbians throughout the Bush administration, right?
Yeah.
This is the guy who was subpoenaed to testify before Congress to account for his behavior and, I believe the legal term is, lied his ass off. The guy that the log cabin Republicans lined up to demand resign?
Yeah, that guy.
Oh, and what happened to him, Andrew? Also, hey, bonus, what happened to the log cabin Republicans while we're at it?
So Block pled guilty in 2010. He was sentenced and then on a collateral appeal was allowed to withdraw his plea and admit instead to destruction of property. So he also served a small amount of probation, right?
All right.
And do you remember the people like that, the log cabin people who seriously argued that Trump was going to be more gay friendly than Hillary Clinton back in 2016?
Sure do.
Oh, those were good times. Those
good times. I'm just sad there isn't a hell for them to go to, Andrew. Well, we need to take a quick break, but then we'll be back with a seriously important story that I wrote, because goodness knows you listeners tuned in to hear my thoughts on politics.
Hey friends, Andrew here for Cleanup on Aisle 45, and today's episode is brought to you in part by Policy Genius. Mashed potatoes, stuffing, cranberry sauce from a can, that's the gross kind. That's a lot on your plate this November, so why not let Policy Genius help by looking for lower home and auto insurance rates for you? Policy Genius makes it easy to compare home and auto insurance in one place. They can help you find home and auto coverage similar to what you have now, but at a lower price. They've saved customers on average $1,250 per year over what they were paying for home and auto insurance. Their team will handle the paperwork to set up your new policy or switch over your current one. Getting started is easy. First, head to policygenius.com and answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property. Then Policy Genius takes it from there. They'll compare rates from America's top insurers, from Progressive to Allstate, to find your lowest quotes. The Policy Genius team can look for new ways to save you more, including bundling your home and auto policies. If they find a better rate than what you're paying now, they'll switch you over for free. Their top-notch service has earned Policy Genius thousands of five-star reviews across Trustpilot and Google, so head to policygenius.com to get started right now. Policy Genius, when it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right.
Welcome back to Clean Up on Aisle 45. All right, Andrew, so today we're going to talk about vaccine mandates, because I would argue there is no mess 45 left behind, no exploded jar of pasta sauce, if you will, larger than the COVID-19 pandemic. And for a while now, experts have been saying the way out of said pandemic is a vaccine mandate. Now, while the numbers vary from survey to survey, the real-world results of vaccine mandates in workplaces have been overwhelmingly successful, with somewhere between 95 and 99% of eligible employees of airlines and healthcare providers taking the shot once it becomes mandated.
Yeah, it's almost as though the free market came up with a solution to the problem, and now the party of limited government would like a regulation to stop companies from insulating themselves from liability and, incidentally, and believe me, I know this is not the primary goal, saving lives in the process, right?
Yeah, I can't have that.
Look, I know this firsthand, right? I took a transatlantic cruise when I was on vacation last month. I was stuck in a self-contained environment, a metal tube with several thousand people on lawless international waters where a plague outbreak would have been a disaster. And we had zero instances. And you know how they managed it? The ship made you show proof of vaccination and undertake a negative antigen test before you got on board. They enforced sort of social distancing rules, mostly by the crew, right? They retested you at sea, and they had an entire deck sealed off, and I mean like metal bulkhead sealed off on deck six in case anybody tested positive for quarantine, right? And so every last person managed to managed to do a thing that we think of as getting back to normal just fine. It worked.
Yeah. And I mean, that seems to be a pretty common misunderstanding among people, is they're like, oh, it's like this forever. And it's like, no, it's not like this forever. It's like this while a huge percentage of the country are like, nah.
That's what herd immunity means. Yeah.
And I also want to say, like, the reason these free market mandates work, I think, is that most unvaccinated people are, contrary to popular belief, willing to get the shot. They're just not in a hurry to do it, right? The problem with vaccine mandates, like in the press, is that they're often sold as like your strongly anti-vax Aunt Kathy shedding a single tear as she goes to get the vaccine so her kids don't starve. But In reality, most of the people getting the vaccine are politically uninformed about the vaccines and COVID, so they just haven't bothered. They're just like, I don't know, my uncle seems really freaked out about it, right? Mandates for many are the push they needed to get the shot. It's the push they need to get all the shots that we currently use that are mandatory, right? Yeah. It's not the third act of Silence where Liam Neeson finally agrees to step on a plate with Jesus's face on it. Sorry, that might be too deep a cut for this show.
Oh no. Look, we do not get enough bewildered messages from our patrons. So by all means, keep going.
Okay, good. I was worried my Dune and RoboCop references were too fresh and topical. So
sure.
Glad I could do the Christian movie Scorsese deep cuts. So many of us were relieved when the Biden administration announced back in September that OSHA would be enforcing mandatory vaccination or weekly testing for all companies over 100 employees starting in January. Not the least of which were, you know, companies, right?
Right.
Well, quite a few businesses up to this point have mandated vaccines, like airlines and healthcare companies. As I mentioned, the looming January date is a chance for those who haven't jumped on board to throw their hands in the air and put their own mandates in place as well.
I cannot stress this enough. I represent small businesses, right? I cannot tell you how much this is at core a self-interest question, right? If your office is a super spreader event, you're going to get sued, right? My clients call me all the time to ask how can they impose reasonable restrictions, right? And if you're thinking about that, you're also worried about employees who want to request religious exemptions or accommodate. It's a real issue. And having a government mandate is an outstanding defense, right?
Yep.
To say, look, we're just operating under cover of law. We're doing what the government tells us to do. And that provides a significant economic benefit to these companies. And I'm stressing that, right?
It would have. But of course, a universe where we finally got everyone vaccinated seems destined for an only shitty timeline and not the shit canoe timeline that we're living in. As once again this week, the 3-judge Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a block against the mandate decided by a lower court last month. Judge Kurt D. Engelhardt, who, in keeping with the theme and title of the show, is a Trump appointee, wrote in his 22-page decision, quote, "From economic uncertainty to workplace strife, the mere specter of the mandate has contributed to untold economic upheaval in recent months." I'm guessing he prefers how economically stable and friendly things have been while 750,000 Americans have died.
Look, I don't mean to go all like technically lawyery here, but like, number one, I never want to hear Republicans again make fun of like the penumbra of the Bill of Rights when, you know, you're talking about the specter of the mandate. Like, go fuck yourself, right? But number two, and far more importantly, economic uncertainty is not a reason that an executive branch cannot implement regulations. Otherwise, there would be no executive branch regulations, which is, of course, what these people want.
Yeah, to tell that to every political analyst from the 2016 election. But don't worry, Judge Crudy D, that's what I call him, we're close like that. He anticipated you, Andrew. He adds, quote, "Of course, the principles at stake when it comes to the mandate are not reducible to dollars and cents. The public interest is also served by maintaining our constitutional structure and maintaining the liberty of individuals to make intensely personal decisions according to their own convictions, even, or perhaps particularly, when those decisions frustrate government officials." The freedom to pwn the libs is especially important when it bothers the Biden administration. Good to know.
A constitutional right to frustrate government is that's news to me. Also, I want you to put a pin in that liberty of individuals language. I have a feeling we'll be talking about that in a little more.
Think so. So before we get into the merits of this particular demonic pitchfork in the ass of culture, I want to ask a more basic question, which is, where and how these freedoms sort of actually should be applied. So as our shared listeners might know, you and I disagree, by which I mean I am wrong, about a lot of the accommodations that most people consider reasonable, right? So like, I don't understand why people get religious accommodations like kosher or organic and shamanistic food in prison, for example. So without you having to teach me the entirety of civics, can you explain how I'm wrong and how oppositions to this vaccine mandate are, in fact, different from otherwise acceptable religious exemptions?
Yeah, and I want to phrase my answer in the context of where religious exemption law was pre-2017.
I was going to say.
Right, which is back when the last time when I could understand what the Supreme Court was doing, right? So if you take kind of that body of religious law, right? The courts have rather consistently since the 1960s drawn a pretty stark dividing line between the kind of exemption you get that is now codified into RFRA with a sincerely held religious belief, which generally gets upheld, versus the kind of objection you have that is based on individual principles or conscience. And in something that I guess made sense to the Supreme Court in the 1960s and has carried through to today, right? Like, if you believe it for a terrible reason, that's constitutionally protected. But if it is a sincerely held point of principle, you get nothing, right? And this came out during the Vietnam War, right, in the various, you know, what were called the draft dodger cases, right? And people were like, oh, if you're a member of a religious sect that is recognized as pacifistic, that was good enough to be exempted from going over to die in Vietnam. But if what you said was, I believe strongly in the principles of nonviolence, and I have lived my life in accordance with those principles, right? You lost, and you had to register for the draft anyway. Right. I mean, your giggling is appropriate. But nevertheless, like, that's a core feature of our law, and it's something that I think really could come into play even at this Supreme Court. in front of a normal Supreme Court, because these objections, like the vaccine objections, are not even like under the slightest bit of scrutiny, they're not even remotely religious, right? It is, you know, a combination of fear mongering and QAnon and I'd rather take horse dewormer and, you know, like, and none of that is, you know, what we think of as typically being a religious objection.
Yeah, no, that is fair. All right. So now that I am thoroughly, though I will say resentfully and ruefully educated, how do you think this thing stands on the merits?
Yeah, and so, you know, by this thing, the Fifth Circuit overturning the vaccine mandate.
Yeah.
The reasoning here, the thing I told you to stick a pin in, is supremely terrifying because... well, here, let me walk through that, right? So remember, this is the party that, as I alluded to earlier, likes to say, oh, yeah, well, where do you find abortion in the Bill of Rights?
They sure do.
Yeah. Answer to that, Fifth and 14th Amendments, but that's not what they mean. They mean literally control F the document for the word abortion, right? Mm-hmm. If that's your test, though, there isn't some fundamental individual right to freedom of contract in the Bill of Rights either, right? So, you know, slightly disparate standards here for the rights they like versus the ones they don't. But look, this kind of broad sweeping language, and I am not being hyperbolic here, has not been seen in legal decisions since what lawyers call the Lochner era, right? That is from a 1905 case called Lochner versus New York, in which the Supreme Court struck down a New York law setting a weekly maximum number of hours worked. And again,
a maximum.
Oh yeah. And again, this was 1905. So it was like 80 hours a week, right? Like, I'm not making that up, right? And the Supreme Court was like, oh, come on. You cannot take away people's inherent God-given liberties to contract themselves, to work themselves to death, right? And the reason they gave was basically the stuff you just read, right? And here's the point. If you ask any lawyer, right, left, right, center, what is the most deplorable era in all of Supreme Court jurisprudence, almost all of them, with the exception of the Trump appointees who don't know and don't care, will tell you the Lochner era, right? They will say this is a time when the Supreme Court engaged in unbridled right-wing activism to overturn every remotely progressive law that was coming out of a country that was going through, you know, a severe shock to the system of being industrialized, the influence of, socialism on a newly emerging economy, right? Like it, and the Supreme Court shut that down for 30 years until FDR threatened to pack the courts.
Well, that in no way sounds like our terrifying present, Andrew. Okay, so my question for you is, what if, as many news agencies have postulated, this thing does make it up to the Supreme Court? Do you, and I'll try not to put my finger on the scale here, think the folks who gave us the decision that no, you're not allowed to close a temple of Orthodox Jews in the middle of New York City at the peak of the pandemic are going to reverse their course on this one?
Challenge accepted. But look, I actually do think that part is a slightly separate question. So if you're looking for a crack of optimism, the court's shadow docket religious exemption cases were about doing the thing that they did, and that is extending what is essentially most favored nation status to churches without ever having to rule on the merits of a case that was briefed for oral argument before them, right? Which is right. A terrifying overreach of power. But here's what they accomplished with that, right? So justices like Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett would say things like, well, you know, if you have a secular exemption and you're going to allow people into liquor stores for 4 minutes, with a mask on to buy the Boda Box Rosé so that your wife doesn't kill everyone in the household, you obviously have to let people in, for an hour and a half to scream at each other and spit on each other while singing and hugging and sharing crackers.
The secular version, the religious version of a liquor store. I've always said that.
And look, like, this is, we're cracking jokes, but that is almost, minus the Boda Box stuff, that is almost word for word, what is in these religious opinions. It's like, if you've crafted a secular exemption, it must go to churches, no matter how dissimilar they are on the face of it.
Okay? Yep. That's
super bad. That's where we are. This would go a step further than that. So let that sink in for a minute. Yeah. And so because it is so completely insane, it's going to start off with four votes in the no column, right? You're going to get the three remaining lawyers on the Supreme Court. You will also get Chief Justice Roberts because he will not want his institutional legacy to be the guy who let plague kill off the rest of the country.
Yeah. Roberts has a real great conscience. He's real concerned about his legacy.
I really think he does not want his grandchildren to read, like, my history of the Lochner Court, and then with a little asterisk that was like, until 2017, when Chief Justice John Roberts presided over the end of the Supreme Court as we know it. But there we go. So the question is, can you peel off another vote? Can you get a Kavanaugh or a Gorsuch?
No.
So there you go. How much does Neil Gorsuch want people not to die?
That's I feel like that answer wouldn't please us, Andrew. I gotta tell you. Okay, right. So I guess that just leaves me with the question I think I'm asking far too often on my shows. What hope do we have, right? Half the country is unvaccinated. The pandemic isn't going away in any real way until they are. Is there a way to end this thing without a working government or legal system or the goodness of other human beings? I feel like I may have answered my own question there at the end.
Yeah, well, I play a happy optimist on my shows and mostly in real life. So let me try it on this one. I remember the 1980s, okay? It was where I formed my formative political opinions. And Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General was a bushy bearded guy named C. Everett Koop. And don't get me wrong, he was a total piece of shit on abortion and AIDS. And yep. I do not want to lionize him for any of that behavior. But he did a thing that I don't know if it remains a model, right? And that was he single-handedly, in the scope of about 3 years changed the culture in this country about smoking cigarettes, right? I grew up at a time when airplanes had smoking sections, right? Like the first 13 rows were smoking. And then, you know, if you didn't like that, you could sit in the back because it's not like smoke would travel inside a sealed tube or anything, right? And like that seems preposterous now, but that's 100% due to the entire seismic social shift that went on in this country, sort of championed by C. Everett Koop. So,
yeah, you know, so what you're saying is we just need to have national leadership that changes the deeply held mindset of society, where the headwinds are multiple billionaire-funded conspiracy theory news outlets that have convinced 35% of this country that Hillary Clinton rapes and murders babies in the basement of a pizza parlor that doesn't have a basement. Got it. So it's easy, people. Yes. It's easy. It's just like smoking on planes. All right. Well, that seems like a perfect time to throw it to our next ad break.
Hi everybody, Andrew here, and this portion of the show is brought to you by Feels CBD. CBD isn't about what you feel, it's about what you don't feel, like stress, anxiety, and pain. If you're in the market for CBD oil, I recommend Feels CBD. Their site is backed by actual scientific research and tailored to different consumers with differing levels of strength, from 600 milligrams for a precious little cinnamon bun like me, to 2400 for people like, you know, we don't have to name them. It's a full-spectrum hemp extract containing less than 0.3% THC, so you'll keep a clear head with no hangover. Overs or addictions. Here's how it works. You place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and you feel the difference within minutes, whether it's to help you sleep, reduce your anxiety, or lessen soreness and pain. And their deliveries are hassle-free and delivered directly to your door without a prescription. Call their free CBD hotline for assistance to find the right dose for you. Their monthly membership can make self-care simple. You'll save money on every order because you can pause or cancel at any time. So start feeling better with Feels. Become a member today by going to feels.com/cleanup, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/cleanup to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. feals.com/cleanup. All right. Welcome back. Now, you know, Eli, we usually do a comings and goings segment here in which I tell you which third assistant to the deputy undersecretary that Joe Biden has managed to nominate this week. But I think we change it up a little bit and talk about the meta story, right?
Ooh.
How is Biden doing in terms of filling out a functional executive branch after years of not just deliberate neglect, but, you know, deliberate efforts to dismantle it from the inside?
All right. So it seems to me, at least, that the answer is not great. On this show, you've previously plugged the Washington Post's Biden appointee tracker. And so I went there. Well, sorry. I had to find my way through 7 paywalls in a cat suit while Sean Connery looked on. But then I went there.
Entrapment references always welcome here, Eli.
Thank you. So I thought they might be. And according to the Washington Post's Biden appointee tracker, as of November 15th, Biden has filled just 179 Senate-confirmed nominees to serve in the executive branch out of 805 total positions.
That batting average doesn't seem great.
Nope, not the Hall of Fame. So that lags way behind Obama's first term and Bush's first term, each of whom had confirmed about 350 such officials by now. That's roughly twice as many. It even lags behind the bumbling incompetence and deliberate sabotage of the Trump administration. So yeah, not great.
All true. But you'll notice that 231 more nominees are, quote, being considered by the Senate, right? That's a backlog larger than the number of total confirmations, right? Over the last 10 months. So late last week, we learned a little bit about why that bottleneck in the pipeline is coming. And spoiler alert, it can be blamed on my old law school buddy, Ted Cruz.
Oh, fantastic. And hey, it's not just Ted Cruz. It's also insurrectionist playboy Josh Hawley.
Oh, God.
So let me see if I have this right. So typically when you're appointing these important executive branch officials, but let's face it, there are over 1,000 of these guys, there's a process to expedite things that every president since ever has gotten to take advantage of. But because that's a norm and not a law, Republicans have figured out how to break it too, and they've done so with a vengeance against Biden. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you have that exactly right. So look, the Constitution provides that certain key executive officials are subject to the confirmation with the, quote, advice and consent of the Senate, right? And like, that's the thing you see for Secretary of State, right? But as you point out, there are 1,200 of these executive branch officials that are that require that advice and consent. So look, obviously, you have to have a Senate confirmation hearing for people like the Attorney General and Secretary of State.
That seems important.
I don't think it's bad faith for the Republicans to demand that, even though their votes are all a, you know, foregone conclusion anyway. But after a while, you're not talking about policy level decision makers, right? You're talking about boots on the ground. You're talking about the people that do the day to day job, career diplomats, the assistant to the undersecretary, and like, I'm not saying these aren't important people. These are really important people for getting stuff done. But you don't need a hearing, right? And so the Senate can waive that, and that all they have to do is call for unanimous consent to proceed with the confirmation of, and then you read out, like, I don't know, how many were pending? 231 names, right? Like, you read out those 231 names, everybody says aye, you gavel, you go home.
Ugh. The word unanimous does not sound like a great word in Mitch McConnell's Senate. So I guess what you're saying is, when I see that Josh Hawley has blocked Biden's nominee for example, Ambassador to Israel, Tom Nides, and six other nominees, what that means is that he voted against the unanimous consent to waive a hearing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And look, because of the backlash, you mess with Israel, you get backlash. So the day after Hawley's hold on Nides, that situation resolved itself, right? But and he's since been confirmed. That's a good thing. But again, the important thing to remember is Nides wasn't a controversial pick. All of these are literally being held hostage for political gamesmanship that no other Senate in history has tried to do. So Hawley has holds on five other officials right now, right? And we'll get into it. And he has said he will only lift them if, and I swear to God, I'm not making this up, several of Biden's top officials, including Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, if they all resign over the administration's handling of the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan.
Cool. Cool. Tight. Love this political system. Works good. So because that's stupid, it means that anyone Hawley doesn't give on will have to go through a full drawn out hearing and process, right?
Yeah. And again, I alluded to this, right? The guys Hawley has his hold on, these are the only ones that we know about, right? There are others, are not decision makers, right? This is Biden's nominee for ambassador to NATO, right? To assistant secretary positions, the nominee for coordinator for reconstruction and stabilization, and the nominee for director general of the Foreign Service.
Well, that's an important one, right? You really want to. Josh Hawley has an eye on the director general of the Foreign Service.
They're important, but not confirmation hearing. Important.
Yeah, but don't worry, he's not the only one using that dumb excuse, because your classmate and close personal friend Ted Cruz is maintaining a blanket hold on nearly all State Department nominees, and he claims it's over the administration's handling of a Russian natural gas pipeline, which seems disproportionate to me. It seems like an odd thing to hold out, but I guess that's the game. By withholding consent, now, as we said, it all has to go through the regular drawn-out confirmation process, which means scheduling individual votes and holding floor debates, where they will waste even more time.
Yeah, and if you're wondering how much time is left on the calendar, right? Like, how often is the Senate actually in session over the next 6 weeks, right, which include two major holidays?
The answer, let me guess.
not often, right? In that limited time, I'm pretty sure Biden would like to not take it all up with a bunch of stupid, meaningless floor votes, right? Like he'd kind of like the Senate to, you know, pass legislation, maybe sign off on that bipartisan infrastructure bill. Well, they've cast that vote already, but the reconciliation bill is still,
I think he's got some stuff, right? He's probably got a thing or two.
There's work that he would like to be done, but this is exactly what Hawley and Cruz, and let's be real, McConnell are thinking, right? There are just two work periods left. That's 4 days next week with a day off for Thanksgiving. And that includes those 4 days include a Friday session that the day after Thanksgiving that I'm pretty sure is going to be lightly attended, right?
Just Newt Gingrich talking to himself. I don't even work here anymore.
I know. How did I die? They didn't change the key.
Point the camera at me.
And then 2 weeks from December 13th to December 31. And again, you might recall there are several major holidays that take place over those 17 days. So that's an impossible schedule to do anything and also confirm 231.
So what you're saying is that if someone like me were super angry that the Biden administration isn't accomplishing everything I want them to do right now, maybe there are some, say, structural roadblocks that are standing in the way that isn't entirely his fault.
That's kind of the lesson of the show, right? Like I think it is important, right? Particularly for those of us who are progressives, right? You and I, and we did this, right? We did this on Scathing Atheist. We did this over on your shows. I believe that you and I had Joe Biden like north of Marianne Williamson on our list of preferred candidates during the primary, but below everybody else, right? Like, I mean, we were way to the left of Joe Biden. And so I get it when I get usually their angry messages on Patreon, desubscribing from the show and accusing me of selling out to a big center or whatever, which by the way, that has not happened. I'm still available to sell out to Big Left if you guys come up with a competing bid.
Chapo Trap House, give us a call.
Yeah, right.
Any fucking time, boys.
So but seriously, like, look, I get it when people say to me, I voted for Joe Biden because he said he wanted free college tuition for everybody. And he hasn't delivered on that. So I'm super mad and I'm going to stay home. And I get that. And if I don't stay home, then we'll continue to elect, you know, these pseudo Democrats who promise me stuff, but then never deliver. I do get it. But I guess what I'm trying to get at in that is two things, right? Number one, sometimes the reason you're not getting what you want is not always as obvious as it appears.
Right.
And, you know, number two, you also have to consider the consequences of that vote when lined up with, you know, the alternative.
Right. Well, and also you got to remember that nobody, not the best intentioned person, is going to sit there reminding you of the good things Joe Biden has done. Right. Like the effects of the child tax credit, which I bang on about all the time, are going to be instrumental in lifting children out of poverty over the next 5 years. Right. Literally hundreds of millions of children will be lifted out of poverty thanks to that child tax credit. But the New York Times cannot post a headline that's like, just a reminder, lots of people who otherwise couldn't afford to feed their kids will feed them this week by getting $300 in a way they have literally never gotten them before or since.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like that is not going to remind you of that. And neither is this infrastructure bill. Right. This infrastructure bill, when you talk to most people about it, they're like, I don't know, some fucking bridges or so. Our infrastructure, this is something that if in 25 years you take an economics class, they will talk about. Otherwise, you ain't never going to hear shit about what this bill does. You're just going to be like, I don't know, my internet got faster around 2025. I have no idea why. It's just, I guess Verizon got their shit to, like, that stuff is not shiny and pretty. And everyone who gets your money on both the left and the right does it by talking about the next scary thing.
Yeah, no, I think that is really an excellent point in terms of the, you know, the direct economic incentives, but also, right, the discursive incentives, the, you know, we, our side feeds off of outrage as much as the other side does.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yes.
Yeah. And it is boring. I know, because I look for a way to make it slightly less boring every week with what we do. But like, yeah, demolishing. There's a reason that you watch like them imploding the casinos on, you know, the Vegas Strip. Like when that happens, it's a, you know, they show that on TV. They do not show you like brick by brick building up the new casino in its place, right? Like,
yeah,
restoring stuff is less spectacular than blowing it all up. Yeah. And we just had 4 years of that. Yeah,
yeah. Rod Serling, the creator of the Twilight Zone, had a great quote, which is that television shows car chases, not commutes.
Yeah, right. That's right? An excellent,
and it's like,
short.
There's a lot more commuting going on than car chases, but then you're like, oh, he's on the 95 and he flipped. He fucking rolled. Right now, they are rolling our country, and we're all watching and being like, oh, that's going to be bad. That's going to be bad. Oh, he's running. He's running on foot.
Great. Now I have that plus your love of cops kind of running through my head. So
ex love of cops.
And I mean, and by the way, just so anyone listening to the show who doesn't know you, that I mean the schlocky 90s
the television
TV show.
I
do not mean your love of police officers,
of law enforcement.
All right. Well, I think that's the show. Eli, thank you so much for coming on to guest host. I've been really looking for an opportunity to do this with you. I really love it. Why don't you tell folks where they can find you if they want more Eli in their ear holes?
All right. I mean, I already covered Entrapment, and I think that's the most important thing I can plug. That movie holds up and is not problematic at all. Don't worry about it. Actually, hey, it is still Vulgarity for Charity, the fundraising drive that our community does once a year for the charity modestneeds.org. They can check out all the info for that over on scathingatheist.com. But as of right now, we've raised just over $60,000. And hey, you can give a dollar to get Andrew to say but or whatever, but you can give $50 and Andrew will roast Josh Hawley for you. So
and I suspect we've already floated if I think if enough people demand that Allison do their roasts, then we're gonna have to. We'll coerce her into doing it.
Absolutely. Into that. If I was anything but a horrifying distraction while you tried to listen to Andrew, you can hear me and my two smart guys over on the Scathing Atheist God Awful Movies Citation Needed, where I threw in two extra smart guys for good measure, D&D Minus and the Skeptocrat.
Hardest working man in podcasting, Eli Bosnick, right there. Thank you so much. And seriously, if you're not listening to those shows, you should listen to those shows. I listen to those shows. They're great shows.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com.
Season 4 of How We Win is here.
For the past 4 years, we've been making history in critical elections all over the country. And last year, we made history again by expanding our majority in the Senate, beating election-denying Republicans in crucial state House races, and fighting back a non-existent red wave.
But the MAGA Republicans who plotted and pardoned the attempted overthrow of our government now control the House, thanks to gerrymandered maps and repressive anti-voter laws. And the chaotic spectacle we've already seen shows us just how far they will go to seize power, dismantle our government, and take away our freedoms.
So the official podcast of The Persistence is back with Season 4. There's so much more important work ahead of us to fight for equity, justice, and our very democracy itself. We'll take you behind the lines and inside the rooms where it happens, with strategy and inspiration from progressive changemakers all over the country.
And we'll dig deep into the weekly news that matters most and what you can do about it with messaging and communications expert, co-founder of Way to Win, and our new co-host, Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
So join Steve and I every Wednesday for your weekly dose of inspiration, action, and hope.
I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
And this is How We Win.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.